I give up.
I'm neutral. I take it either way. Okay, now I left some details from the first chapter, which I didn't explain, what we had a chance to say yesterday. Ahasuerus threw this party, and we said it was to support his authority, his power, to gain him popularity. We didn't explain why it was in the third year of his reign. I want to teach you a little bit about how to look at text. Suppose somebody says, well, it was in the third year because it took him 3 years to put things together. You know, I mean, he came in, he was a general, he took over, he had to solidify his administration, get people appointed, set up the rules. That's why it's in the third year. See, an explanation like that will be reasonable if you're trying to explain historically why it happened in the third year. But it will be less reasonable if what you're trying to explain is why it's written in the book. What do I care about how long it took him to set up his authority? Or set up his, you know, why is that important to me? Why is that background for the party?
Why is it important that there's 127 provinces in Hodu and Kush?
Well, in general, that would be a good question. Why should it be important? And Chazal do say that the Sora died at the age of 127, and those two numbers being identical are not accidental. Just as I pointed out that the phrase when he goes yelling through the streets, that phrase is almost identical to Esau's screaming when he found out that he wasn't getting the blessing. So that means that this book is echoing things in older books, and the reader of older books who knows them sees it here and says, oh, 127, where are you in that book? I don't think it appears anywhere else, the whole Tanakh, 127.
But God didn't say word for word what this was to be, right? So
I think most would agree that it is inspired. But I said this yesterday.
I understand, but how did they know that they're the ones supposed to write it and all that stuff? And how people...
What?
How people used to know, like Tanakh, right? How did we know that Hashem picked them to do it? If it wasn't straight from God's word, that they were inspired through God, how do we know that they were the chosen ones, right?
And if it was dictated by God, word for word, how would we know that God really dictated it?
Okay.
The answer is that they know it because they experience it. Right? And these are not ordinary people. I mean, Esther was the one to whom all these miracles happened. She was the one who's the figure in saving the Jewish people. So, you know, she's not just somebody on the street writing a book.
They also name all the people that they put a lot of names in it. Like all the people that Achashverosh sent to tell Vashti, probably says all their names.
Yeah, certainly it reflects the facts of the story. I'm just pointing out that there are two different questions. One question is, why did it happen that way? That's an interesting question, which needs to be asked. But in addition to that, there's another question. Why does the book bother to record it? And if the answer to the first question makes the second question unanswerable, then it won't help us. Now, sometimes the written books of the Tanakh make reference to information that certainly the people of the time would know, and later people would know if they study the appropriate sources, and it really isn't in the book. There's nothing in the book that will tell you. As a matter of fact, this year, the third year of his reign, was a year in which it was predicted previous year was a year it was predicted that the 70 years of exile would be up, and the Jews would go back to the land of Israel. God would redeem them and take them back to the land of Israel. And at this time, in his third year, those 70 years were up. According to that calculation, they were finished. And one could draw the conclusion, Chas v'Shalom, that the prophecy didn't come true. Now, we have to appreciate the way people in those times looked at the Jewish people and looked at their history. People knew about the exodus from Egypt. And they knew that Egypt was devastated. So holding the Jews captive is a tricky business. Look what happened to the Egyptians. Furthermore, the Jews claim they have a prophecy. A prophecy that after 70 years in this exile, they're going to be redeemed. What's going to happen to the people that are holding them? Furthermore, one of Ahasuerus' predecessors, a fellow named Belshazzar, he also made a calculation. A calculation of 70 years, based on a different starting point, because the starting point for the 70 years is not 100% explicit. And he calculated it was over, and the prophecy was not fulfilled. And he also made a party, and he took out vessels from the temple, which were in the treasure houses of the Babylonians, because they're the ones that conquered the temple. He took out vessels from the temple and used them at his party. And that night he was assassinated. If I remember correctly, he was assassinated by his own children. So, some people drew the conclusion that that wasn't such a good idea. Having the party and using the temple's vessels on those grounds wasn't such a good idea. And they put the vessels back in the treasure houses and they adopted a more conservative stance about these matters. Now Ahasuerus says, I have a calculation. And I believe the calculation is correct. And when the 70 years were over, according to his calculation, he made a party. Why did he make a party? Because I told you that this man is insecure. This man is worried about danger and unpopularity at every course. And one major insecurity is, if I'm holding these people when the 70 years come to an end, and God decides that they should go back to the land of their fathers, like he did taking them out of Egypt, I could be in serious trouble. Like Pharaoh was in serious trouble. But no, according to his calculation, 70 years went by, and he got away with it. So he's making a celebration. And I told you we would come back to this. If you look in verse 7, it says the drinks were served in golden goblets, no two goblets alike. Well, that is the suggestion and aid from your helpful friendly translator. But if you read the Hebrew, it doesn't exactly say that. The Hebrew is quite difficult to understand. The hashkos b'klei zahav, drinking in golden vessels, v'kelim, and vessels, mikelim, from among vessels, shonim, various. So this is how it reads. Drinking in golden vessels and vessels from among various vessels. Which really says nothing at all. Zion. It really says nothing at all. The chelim, mikelim, shonim. Vessels from among various vessels. It's meaningless. It doesn't add any information. The words themselves have no clear meaning. It's a very funny thing to write. Now, when you hear the Megillah read, if you pay attention to the music, pay attention to the musical sounds, you'll hear that at this point it sounds very different. The reader will read it with the musical chant of Eicha, of Lamentations. Here is where the text hints that Ahasuerus did what his predecessor Belshazzar did. He took the vessels that were in the treasure houses from the temple, and he took them out, and he used them at the party. Think of the rest of the story. Right? He is doing, indeed, what his predecessor does, but as Michael suggests, he does get away with it. Now the question is, what are we supposed to make out of it? We'll get to that later, Mr. Shem. But at any rate, that explains what this phrase is doing here, and it shows that this book is based on history which isn't written in the book. None of the books of the Torah or the Tanakh is designed to be independent. None of them is designed to be independent. They're not supposed to be self-contained. They're not supposed to be that if someone visits from Mars and has never heard of Jerusalem and never heard of the Torah, never heard of Shabbos, will be able to pick it up and get a complete explanation. It's not an encyclopedia. It's a story written as part of the history of a nation for people who know the history and are living the history and part of the history, and it sums up certain aspects that they want them to know. At any rate, that's what's going on over here. Now, okay, that part isn't explicit. I'll come back to it when I do the deeper philosophical themes, which we'll get to in Yud Hashem next week, sometime at the end of next week. Did we leave anything else out here? Yeah, he's sitting in the capital. He's sitting in the capital. The capital is, you know, he's showing himself in the maximum authority. He's sitting on the throne. Sitting on the throne in the capital, showing himself the maximum authority, and giving this party, as I told you, to shore up his authority and his popularity. Now, I just go reverse again the explanation I gave you at the end yesterday to see if some people I felt were not happy with it, and let's see if that's true. If not, we can go on. She doesn't come. Vashti doesn't come when he calls her. Why? Because she's the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, and she says, I'm not coming. So it's a crisis. It's a crisis of authority. It's sort of like, well, you're too young, but in history books, if you ever read about a fellow named Richard Nixon, the greasiest fellow who ever lived. This guy was a greasy, he was just awful. And at a certain point, the Supreme Court ordered him to turn over certain documents, and he said, no. After all, the American government is based on three separate institutions. There's the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. And he said, you guys are the judicial, and I'm the executive. And the executive doesn't have to knuckle under the judicial. It's three powers, and each power is equal. You can't tell me what to do. That could have caused a civil war. That could have caused a breakdown of the whole government. And it was, well, before they sort of knuckled them under to do that. So here, she's causing a constitutional crisis. Who's running the show over here? On the other hand, he doesn't feel strong enough to take her on directly. What am I going to do? Just challenge the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar is going to raise all sorts of questions of my legitimacy. Along comes Memuchan, who, as I told you, really Haman, and he says, make out of it a feminist issue. You'll at least get all the men in the kingdom on your side. In those days, if you had the men, that's what counted. You know, the women didn't count separately for anything. They couldn't vote. Making a rebellion of wife against husband, and say we're putting down this rebellion and we're commanding that men should be respected by their wives, rule in their own homes. And not only is it a question of Vashti, but this is a law that will go out to the whole empire, and that law will be binding on every man and every woman. Things should be done in this way. Wow, that's terrific. You're automatically going to have the support of all the people who count, namely all the men. You know, if this tape is being listened to by someone who's desperately blinded by politics, I'm now speaking for the ancient Persians, right? I'm not speaking for myself. I'm not saying the men are the only thing that count. I'm saying that was their perception. That's why they made this law. Okay? So don't take these words and quote it. I heard a rabbi say that only men count and use it, because it won't be correct. Okay, everybody with me? Terrific. Chapter 2. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, it took him a while to sober up, 2 or 3 months, I guess, and he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Now, if you read this very literally, it is a bit odd. After he sobered up and he calmed down, he remembered Vashti and remembered what she had done. You mean he sort of lost track of it. You know.
He's
drunk. Gosh, I haven't seen Vashti around for the past couple of months. I wonder where she is. Maybe she's on vacation, you know, or maybe she's going to have some new gowns fitted, or maybe she's running, you know, hunting with the dogs. Where could she be? Oh, it slipped my mind. Right, she rebelled against me, and we had her deposed, and according to Chazal, she was killed. Now I remember. Oh, it just takes me a while to place things, you know. Probably not right. Forget something like that. That is important to understand. The word zachar in Hebrew, the verb, which is translated to remember, doesn't mean any of those things. It doesn't mean that you forgot in between. Lizkor in Hebrew, at least in biblical Hebrew, means to use a past fact for making a decision. You make a decision, some things in the past are relevant, a lot of what's in the past isn't relevant. Lizkor, especially when it's used with respect to God, but here it's just used with respect to a human being. Doesn't mean to remember what you forgot. What it means is, now has come time to do something about that. And that's why the next verse, the king's pages said, this is what you should do about it. I mean, if he just remembered it in his mind, then how would they know what to suggest? We're not talking about remembering his mind. We're talking about resolving to make a decision about that past fact. There's no queen. What should we do about it? And the pages, wherever they are, is what the Hebrew is in Hebrew. I don't know. They make up these words. They have chamberlains. Chamberlain is somebody who makes the bed. Right? That's not what it is. A chamber is a room in French. That's where they took it from. The chamberlains are not people who make the beds, and pages are not people who run around and call for people. These are his servants, and they're his advisors. Where do they get these words from? Okay, so what do they say? Let there be sought for the king a beautiful young maiden. Let the king appoint commissioners in all the provinces of his kingdom. They may gather together every beautiful young maiden to Shushan, the capital, to the harem, under the charge of Haggai, the king's chamberlain, guardian of women. Let the cosmetics be given. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This advice pleased the king, and he followed it. Now, quiz time. Take what I told you yesterday and explain what's going on. First of all, you should be able to see some peculiarities here. And second of all, use what I said yesterday to explain what's going on. This is another example of the theme that we've been talking about.
This is how it was done in those days.
Say again?
This is how it was done in those days.
I think it was not done this way. I think it was definitely not done this way. I would think that this would be almost unique to do it this way. Almost unique. I don't imagine you'll find cases like this anywhere else. Yeah.
I mean, on one hand, he doesn't want to get like a legitimate queen because then he's going to have that power struggle again.
Oh.
But on the other hand, he wants to be able to show that he has the power to get whatever girl in the whole nation that he wants to.
You didn't carry the first book too far enough. Let's start with the question. He's got it right, but he didn't push the answer far enough consistently. Is this the sole qualification for a queen? She's beautiful. That's the whole story. You don't want a woman with political connections. How were marriages made by kings? They were made to queens of other countries, to princesses of other countries, to cement international relations. This isn't a guy who's going to go home with a girl. This is a king. He's running a kingdom. You have a big province, and you want the people of the province to pay taxes and ensure the loyalty. Pick a woman who can do that. Pick a woman with brains. Pick a woman with money. Pick a woman with connections. Something. Queen. You want pretty girls? You have a harem full of pretty girls, as many as you want. You don't make a pretty girl queen. That's not how you get a queen.
That's what says Zohar. Because we know what happens when he
has. Oh, so now he suggests that if you get a woman who's got political connections, you get a woman who's got brains, you get a woman who's got money, you've got competition. See, here he picks a woman. He doesn't want her to have any independent leg to stand on. She's got to be totally dependent on him. Now here's where he could have pushed it further. Totally dependent on him. So what is he choosing her for? What element is he using to make the choice? Only beauty. Just beauty. Look at the last words of the advisors. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. Her sole claim to fame is that she pleases the king. No, and suppose if things will get difficult with her, she says, you don't please me anymore. Bye. I only chose you because you please me. That's your only key to the palace. You please me. Do something to displease me. Goodbye. That's what he wants. He wants a girl who's totally dependent on him. Nobody could mount an independent power base. By the way, I just want you to know, it's common for rulers to periodically kill all of their closest advisors, all of their closest supporters, just to eliminate a power base. Stalin did that regularly. They'd have somebody in for 10 years and kill him. Because otherwise, if he's your prime minister, so that a lot of people are dependent upon him, he can give out favors and people will, and gain leverage that way. So he builds up a power base. Here with the queen, he doesn't want to take any chances. Yeah.
I said before, that's how Alexander was saying that he didn't just go and do it himself. Again, people told him what to do.
Yes, but here it doesn't say anything about Kedas and the Chok. What it says over here is his advisors advised him what to do. They understand him. They understand him. Just as Haman knew what to advise him to turn it into a populist issue, because he knows that the king is afraid.
It's like there wasn't a problem with him not being able to choose the queen
anyway. Oh, I guess not. I guess not. Because they don't mention the idea of the laws and the customs. They just say, here, do it this way.
Why did he need advice on this one?
Well, my guess is that this is a decision with lots of consequences. If you don't take a woman with political connections, you're giving up. You're giving up a certain kind of connection which other people feel is useful. On the other hand, if you do, then you are going to invite, I'll tell you, no, there may be something else here. There may be, not, in addition to his political insecurity, there may be an individual insecurity as well.
That's a good
observation. Chazal do say there's some difference of opinion whether he was foolish or wicked, and it doesn't have to be an alternative. He could be foolish and wicked. There are people like that. We even have some today. So it could be that he's personally insecure as well as politically insecure. Yeah, somebody else's hand was up?
Don't you think it's a little crazy that Mordechai and he comes up with this whole plot that's like a little like they're all like 90% of it just relies on miracles. Like, why did
Mordechai?
You try to kill him?
Mordechai?
It was Mordechai who sent Esther to go to
the... We didn't get there yet. What are you talking? You're talking now three chapters ahead?
No, it's right here. There was a Jewish man in the Red.
One sec. I didn't read that yet, right? Let's read it. Let me say something about it. Maybe a question is still alive. So we'll hear the question. Okay, that's the background. Finally, now we get to the beginning of the Jewish side of the story. The Jewish man is Shushan, the capital. His name is Mordechai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, Benjamin. Okay. Putting in the names of his ancestors, so we have a rule that if a person is a tzaddik and you mention his ancestors are tzaddikim also. Also, who knows, but there might have been one man named Mordechai, so this identifies who he is. What do I care what tribe he comes from?
Does that discount anyone before Kish?
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. But what do I care what tribe he belongs to? Many people are identified in the Torah that I don't tell you what tribe they come. Not always, anyway. We'll put that on hold. We'll come back to it. Who was exiled from Yerushalayim? With Yechoniah, the king of Yehuda, who Nebuchadnezzar had exiled. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. So he... Okay, he's from the original exiles. He wasn't born in Shushan. He came from Eretz Yisrael. And he reared, in other words, he was like a foster father to Hadassah, who is Esther, his uncle's daughter. So Mordechai and Esther are related as cousins, first cousins.
He Esther?
Sorry?
He Esther.
Yeah, so now you have two names here. Hadassah, she's Esther. It's interesting to figure out why. Who's she really? Can't tell. He reared Hadassah, she is Esther. But she's obviously also Hadassah. Because she has no father or mother. So they passed away. And she was very beautiful. And when her father mother died, Mordechai took her, now, Libas Kamin, took her as a daughter, or, according to some, he married her.
Is it beautiful in, like, widows, or means in features?
Well, it really means, if I remember correctly, one is form, and one is the klasterponim, it's the
countenance.
Yeah, I guess. Another word that doesn't say anything. But it's the impression that the face makes on you. You know, there's the overall beauty of the person, and then there's the impression that the face makes on you. The Mona Lisa, well, you get his face. The rest of the person doesn't figure. And it isn't this expression on the face. I don't know how to explain it too much. What words to say?
Some people have, like, cat-like features.
This is a face that is arresting. You know, when you look at it, you're drawn to look at it. Again, not because of the expression. It could be a variety of expressions. The person could appear happy, or could appear sad, or could appear contemplating, or could appear anxious. It's the kind of face that draws you. And then there's the general beauty of the person. But I think they're both physical. But neither they imply midos according to Chazal and everything else. But the blank shot is it's physical. Now, when the word of the king was heard, and the word of his king and his rule was heard, and the many young girls, young women, I guess, naros, means like teenage, were gathered into the capital. Esther was taken to the house of the king by Haggai, the man in charge of guarding the women. Now, I don't know how many of you know Hebrew, but if you pay attention to the verbs in this book, a tremendous number of verbs are passive. It happened. It was done. They were gathered. She was taken. Things happen much more so than people do things. That's a linguistic theme here. It's a linguistic theme. And Rav Huttner, pointed out that this linguistic theme, that the verbs here are in the passive, is reflected in Chazal as well. How does the first Mishnah in all of Shas begin? May I next word? Kairin Eshma Ba'aretz. From when do we read? We read the Shema in the evening. How does the first Mishnah of Megillah begin? HaMegillah? Nikras. The Megillah is read. Not we read the Megillah. The Megillah is read. Chazal imitated this linguistic style that you have in Sefer Esther. In Megillah Esther. By changing from what they wrote. I mean, reading Shema and reading Megillah Esther is the same verb, reading. But the Shema is active and this one is passive. We'll see why.
Is Haggai somebody special?
Sorry?
Is Haggai somebody special?
I don't know. I don't remember. Why do we have his name?
He keeps saying it.
Yeah. Good question. I don't remember. Good question. So Chazal, see whether it is. And the young woman, meaning Esther, but now her name isn't used. The young woman was good in his eyes, and she tisa chesed lefanav. She carried chesed in front of him. In other words, the picture you have here is that he's charmed by her. Not that she charms him, but he looks at her and she just captivates him. She's the kind of person that people are drawn to. She's the kind of person who people just, you know, take a breath and say, wow, Wow. There are people like that. And she was a person like that, doing nothing.
Everything's double luscious that her looks is good.
Here it's more. Here, it's, well, this is internal. She was good in his eyes. That doesn't say anything about her looks. She was good in his eyes. And she caused him to feel that he wanted to do chesed for her.
What, taking him to do chesed for her, or to do chesed for himself?
What's that?
Taking him to do chesed for her.
Taking him, and what does she be taking?
Him taking her, that's him doing chesed for her?
He's not taking her, what are you talking about here? She's with 10,000 girls that are gathered together for the beauty contest, right? She's taken in because the guards went around rounding up all the beautiful girls, and she ended up in the prison with, I mean, the palace prison, with all of them. But when he is in charge of them, she stands out. And therefore, since he's in charge of preparing them, he feels motivated to do more for her than he did does for the other girls. And he hurriedly, sorry about hail, it could be hurried, cosmetics and allowances of delicacies, and
wasn't there a massage that said that she was actually green or something like that?
Yeah, but I'm dealing with the text as much as I can.
Green?
Yeah, once you start with Medrash, you might as well just open the Medrash and read the Medrash. It's a separate study, and it's really endless. I'm dealing only with things that are relevant to the pshat and the verses as best possible. And the seven maidens to give her that are appropriate to give her from the house of the king. In other words, he gave her everything that everybody gets, but faster, with more care. And he put her, well, it's really the text only says he made her different, she and her mates, he made her different from all the other women. He gave her the best. Now, Esther did not tell her, declare her people or her birthplace. This is her homeland, really, not birthplace, her homeland. But Mordechai commanded her that she shouldn't say. So she's here, anonymous. Now, that's not too hard to understand. The guards are going through. Shushan is the capital. So in the capital, you'll have people from all places, all different kinds of places, people on business missions to the capital and the military missions to the capital. So this is a hard place to play. You know, if she was in an outlying province, you could guess where she's from. But over here, you wouldn't know. And the guards didn't have identity papers in those times. So they didn't care. It's a pretty girl. Take her into the palace and ask the parents and get these papers and something like that. So, and now she's maintaining an anonymous stance. Who are you? My name is Esther. That's it. Nothing else.
So okay. She doesn't give a false identity, or she just...
My guess is she didn't give any identity, because to give a false identity is risky. You know, they'll check up on it. As I'm pointing out here, it's not surprising. When she becomes queen and still manages to maintain her anonymity, that's amazing. That already, I think, is already pointing in the direction of something unusual happening. But here, it's not unusual at all. They had thousands of girls. And Mordechai comes every day before the courtyard, where the women are, to know the situation with Esther, what's happening with her, and how she's doing now. How she got this information out to him, whether she did it through a bribe, through a guard, tossing a letter with a stone over the fence, or whatever it is, but she obviously did this in such a way that no one connected Mordechai with her. Maybe every day, in the daytime or the nighttime. Anyway. Now, comes Esther's turn to go into Ahasuerus, as the end of the time that every woman was prepared, 12 months, because that's how they did it, 6 months with oils, and 6 months with perfumes, and with all the various cosmetics. Imagine, every girl gets made up for a year. She certainly can't complain that she was turned down on the grounds that she didn't have every advantage. And that's how the girl comes to the king. And whatever she wants in addition, there was a certain standard, and then whatever she wants, she can have jewelry of whatever, you know, eyeshadow, special sandals, whatever she wants, to the king's house. Yes, thank you. This is the procedure. In the evening she comes, and in the morning she goes back to the house of the women. Second time round. Now, under the tutelage, under the care of Shashgaz, a different guy, the one who's in charge of the concubines. And she doesn't go to the king unless she's called. She wants her, and she's called by name. So here it is, you know, round robin. Every night a different girl. And every morning they go back. And the next night a different girl. Because each time he says no. Next night it's on to the next. And when Esther's turn came. Oh, Esther. Esther, the daughter of Abihail, who was the uncle of Mordechai, whom he had taken to be his daughter, or perhaps his wife, to come to the king. No, all of a sudden, look at this. The whole lineage, the whole family connection, and now the name of the uncle. We didn't have that before. How come all of a sudden, right here, all this is mentioned here. So I'll tell you why. Because, as I told you, when the books of the Tanakh write something, it means it's relevant to understand what's going on. Now, let's picture Esther. She goes in, she might be taken as queen. In one way or another, she's going to be forced to have relations with this guy. This prostate goy. What does it mean to her? What does it mean to her? What is she feeling? How does she picture, how does she interpret what's going on here? So number one, she's a tzedekes. Number two, being a tzedekes, she has tznius in her bones. This is the grossest possible violation of tznius. Gross! And it's publicly known. Gemara in Sanhedrin makes it clear that this is publicly known. So it's the grossest violation of tznius in public. Because it's publicly known. Not that the people will be there observing it, but everybody knows. And she is the cousin of the head of the Sanhedrin. And her father, Abihail, comes from a line of distinguished people, going back to princes. So it is from the greatest heights to the greatest depths. If anything could cause a person to despair, if anything could cause a person to, Rahman HaTzal, loses Amunah, this would be it. This is where I belong. This is what the Hashgacha wants for me. This is how she walked in. It's very similar to when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Abraham, take now your son, your only one, the one whom you love, Isaac. And the commentator says, if you're going to say Isaac in the end anyhow, so what do you need the lead up for? And one explanation is, God is saying to him, don't go blank on me. Don't tune out. Don't, because of the horror of it, don't turn yourself off. When you take your son up that mountain, you have to feel that he's your son, that he's your only one, and that you love him, and that he's Isaac. All that has to go into it. That's what I want you to feel when you're going up to sacrifice. So here also, she's going in with all of this to this horrible event. Now, but in particular, any girl who goes in gets the right to choose whatever she wants. She didn't ask for anything. Only what the guy in charge, tells her to do, that's what she does. Because she's totally passive. She's totally passive, as a DG has to be. If she's totally passive, then this counts as onus. And because it's onus, it has certain qualifications, so she doesn't have to give up her life rather than have relations with this goy. That's what the Gemara says over there. So she does nothing. She just follows orders and follows the rules. That's all. But she doesn't initiate anything. And even so, it says, Esther, now here the word for charm is used directly, no se schein. Everybody looked at her and was charmed by her. Everyone who saw her was charmed.
What does it mean literally?
I don't know if it has a literal meaning. Chen is related to chinam, for nothing. Chanun means, I give you for nothing, I give you with no reason, no justification, I give you because I want to give you. Chen, I understand, but you know, what is charm? Charm means, I like it, I'm hypnotized by it. I just find myself drawn to it. I don't have any reason. I don't have any real... I can't tell you that it's really good for me. I'm going to make a profit or it's good for my health. I have no calculation, no cheshbon. Just inexplicably. You know, it's sort of, in a way, it reduces you. You're less human. When you're charmed by something, in a way, you're less human. Animals have desires. They desire because they desire. That's all. Here, you're charmed for no reason. That's the kind of thing that it is. Which, again, is a very weak position to be in. Why are people reacting to me like this? Why do people seem to want to help me and want to improve me and so on and so on? Is it because I'm smart? Is it because I'm rich? Is it because I'm strong? Is it because I have good connections? So these are things that I can exploit. No, it's no reason. They just like to do it. That's pretty insecure. So then maybe they won't like it tomorrow. I don't know why it is. I don't know what it is about them that makes them respond that way. It's just very strange that that's what people do. So again, it puts you in a very insecure position. And Esther was taken. Passive verb. She didn't go. To the king. To the palace. In the 10th month, Teves, in the 7th year of his reign. So this process has taken how long?
4 years.
4 years. Okay, so that means there are about 1,400 new concubines in the area. Okay. He's rich, you know. He can support 1,400 concubines, right? Because every night they go, you know, how many months it took them to set it up? Maybe it was 3 years, 1,000 concubines, right? That's what you're talking about. Every night. Till finally, Esther's turn comes. Yeah.
But how do we know that when it says that he remembered it, that was immediately afterwards?
I didn't say it was immediately afterwards. I gave a year up. Right? It took him time to decide to do something about it. Probably took time to set up the whole mechanism, start gathering the girls from various places in the provinces. It's 2 years, so it's 700 new. I'm just pointing out, you know, what we're talking about here. Every night, the 700 nights, 800 nights, 1,000 nights, and then finally, Esther comes. And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she attracted charm and chesed in front of him, more so than all of the virgins. And he put the crown on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti. Now, he's made her queen. Okay. Then he makes a big celebration. Well, I guess it's something to celebrate. Mishteh. That means drinking party. Basically, it's a celebration. For all his officials and servants. The celebration of Esther. What's missing here?
Not to like the army and everyone.
No, what's missing here? What did she do? What did Vashti do? When the king made his drinking celebration, Vashti made her drinking celebration. Esther doesn't make any celebration. It's not up to Esther to make celebrations. She's just there to be his object. That's all. She has no independence.
It said more than other women twice.
Yeah, it's worse than that. It's not twice. It said more than other women and more than other virgins. It's the second time it says virgins. So it sounds like, you know, he had his own harem before this process started. Before this process of taking virgins and trying to... So he loves her more than all the other virgins who were suggested to be the new queen, and more than all the other women in the harem. He loved her more than any other woman that he'd ever had. Okay, so he makes a celebration. I can understand that. It's a reasonable thing to do. You have a queen. And a reduction or some kind of release to the provinces. I guess it says reduced taxes or something. Released taxes, released debts to the provinces. And gave out gifts according to the hand of the king. In other words, gifts worthy of the king. The way a king gives out gifts. That's pretty pretty extravagant, but maybe this is the extravagant Ahasuerus who's just, you know, making a big splash. And it was when virgins were gathered in a second time. Yeah, what's that for? You know, I mean, maybe he likes virgins, who knows? But why is he doing it, and why is it mentioned? And Mordechai is sitting at the gate of the king. Esther does not declare who her homeland and not her people, as Mordechai commanded her. And she does what Mordechai tells her, just as she did when she was under his care. Now the question is, what's the connection between these thoughts? Right? He makes a party, and he gives a reduction to the in taxes, I guess, to the provinces, and he gives gifts, and he takes in new virgins, and Mordechai's sitting there, and she doesn't tell her ancestry, her people, and her homeland. So the connection is that the king was very curious. Who is this woman? What is her background? To what people does she belong? And he asked her to tell. And she said no. The reason she said no is because Mordechai told her not to tell. Now, here she is saying no. Well, that bothers him, as it should, although it's not public. It's not public. This isn't a public defiance of his authority. But it bothers him that she says no. But he loves her. He can't help it. He's charmed by her. So he's a sort of inner conflict there, you know. I really shouldn't put up with this, but what can I do? So he sort of he takes measures to try to discover it. Number one, he makes such a splash in the entire empire that everyone will be talking about. He releases taxes across the empire, and he gives special gifts, and he throws this tremendous celebration. Everybody will be talking about it. If everybody's talking about it, presumably someone said, "Oh, Esther, that's the one. I remember. I saw her." And someone will come forth and say who she is. Then, when that doesn't work,
But he couldn't ask for someone to tell him who it is, because then people know that she's not telling him who he is.
Good for you. Then he gathers in virgins a second time to frighten her. Why would he be gathering virgins a second time? He's preparing for another queen, you know. He's had it with this one. She isn't telling him the truth. So he tries to stimulate information in the kingdom, and he tries to get her to be frightened. But no, she doesn't take it. Mordechai told her to keep it quiet. Now this is very important, because later, at a certain point, she says to the king, "I want X, Y, Z, and tomorrow I will do what the king wants of me." And nowhere do you find anywhere where he wants anything of her. But if you put this together over there, you'll know that there's been a long-standing thing for years that he's wanted something, and she's been refusing him. And now finally she says, "I'm going to do it," and that's a key to what happens at that time.